You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the president used vulgar language in a meeting on immigration Thursday to describe African nations. A politics and foreign policy expert weighs in on the controversy. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, a lawsuit from residents living near the future site of the Foxconn plant, a new entry in the race for governor, and a new ad campaign to lure millennials from Chicago to live in Wisconsin. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Let's start with the Foxconn plant, this development now going on. And there's a lawsuit against the village of Mount Pleasant, the future site of Foxconn. And this is from a group of a dozen homeowners near Foxconn's land who are slated to have their property taken by the village with the process of eminent domain. So what are they claiming here in this suit?
Sure. So, so for the Foxconn plant to be built, some people are going to have to lose their homes. It's built not in a very densely populated area, but in an area that there are some homes. And so so eminent domain, of course, is the process by which the government can force people to move. There are a lot of conditions on that, one of which is that the homeowners need to get paid. But as you can imagine, it is always a cause of controversy when people are getting kicked out of their houses. So this dozen residents in the area have filed a federal lawsuit to try to stop it from happening. They make the claim, among other claims, that that the project is for the benefit of a private company, that this is not a public benefit, which is what allows the government to take private land. And probably, maybe more importantly, they also claim that they're being paid much less than some of their neighbors who are in the same deal.
And have we heard from the village of Mount Pleasant about this?
Well, so you know, their view is that there's no merit to this lawsuit. This will be heard in court, and I think that to some extent, on a project this size, a certain amount of legal wrangling is actually an expected part of going forward with something like this. We're looking at the project spans 2,900 acres in the area. The question really, it may come down to, are these homeowners getting a fair price or getting a legally acceptable value for their property? It's possible that they could block this from going forward, but that feels like that may be unlikely.
And there's also been reporting on a group of renters at a different site told that they would need to find a new place to live, got eviction notices from landlords in preparation for selling to Foxconn. What's the latest on that?
Right, part of the same process, right? There's a whole, you got to move folks out of the way. And the landlords, what had happened was the tenants had gotten these notices that said they had less than a month to get out, 28 days, to leave, the bare minimum of time that they could be granted. And if you're a renter, that is a hardship. That can be a lot to ask. So the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported on this, and the landlords responded that they would give the tenants 90 days, so a little bit more time to find a new place to live.
We're going to look more at that issue coming up next Thursday at 4 here on Central Time. Want to move on to the governor's race. Rob, a lot going on there. Another Democrat with some name recognition joining the race for governor, Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, threw his hat in the ring. What does he bring to the table?
Soglin is the mayor of Madison since more or less forever. He is 72 years old, and I think that Jason Stein of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in his piece and others made the comparison that that Soglin is a Bernie Sanders type of figure. He's a septuagenarian. He's has a certain gruffness about him, and he's a liberal guy. And that is, as we have seen in Wisconsin, which was a base of support for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, that has a certain appeal, and so I think that's going to be part of what Soglin tries to tap into in the Democratic primary.
Governor Walker tweeted about Soglin entering the race, saying, quote, "The last thing we need is more Madison in our lives." Soglin says, "Hey, wait a minute, we've had a good economic record in the state." Here's a listen to Soglin.
"Our success is far superior to the rest of the state. And when you take Dane, the seven counties that comprise the rest of the region, we are the ones that are making him look good. And he'd better say thank you."
So this is Walker versus one of many Democratic candidates. Why do you think we'll see other candidates singled out by the Republicans and Governor Walker, or are they going to wait and see who wins this thing?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is probably noteworthy that Soglin appears to be Walker's favorite Democratic gubernatorial candidate, and that could be for good reasons or bad. But yeah, for whatever reason, the governor is motivated to launch these attacks on Soglin, which has the effect. I mean, Walker knows what he's doing. Has the effect of elevating Soglin's candidacy as well. I guess it's because he's is high profile as a liberal Madisonian, and that is of course unpopular in some parts of the state. But it really, I mean, the substance of fighting is a little dumb. What I think it shows is how comfortable Walker and Wisconsin's Republican politicians are in treating Madison as some sort of foreign country. I mean, it is weird. You know, Madison is in Wisconsin, and Governor Walker is the governor of Wisconsin. So to set up a Wisconsin versus Madison dynamic is, I don't know what to make of that.
Rob Menser is with us from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. We're looking at some of the top state news. And people have pointed out, while there's this back and forth over Madison versus the rest of Wisconsin, Wisconsin's using Madison to market itself to young professionals in Chicago with a new ad campaign. It launched this week in print ads and in video form. Here's a listen to one of the online ads.
An hour commute or an hour with friends? In Wisconsin, the average commute is less than 22 minutes. So you'll have more time to do the things you love. Wisconsin, it's more you.
And there are images of Madison with the Capitol in the backdrop, or one of the lakes in the backdrop. Tell us about this campaign, Rob.
Right. This is the $1 million effort to bring people to Wisconsin. And, I think there's some appeal to that, right? Highlight the quality of life aspects of living in Wisconsin. Indeed, it is true that, the commutes in the Chicagoland area are horrible. And who wouldn't want to live in a beautiful state like ours? So, there's also the true fact that Illinois has the highest rate of people leaving the state in the United States, and Chicago specifically, at least according to some measures, is the city that is losing population at the highest rate, major city in the U.S. So Illinois has its own problems, and this is an attempt by Wisconsin to capitalize on them.
And before we let you go, Rob, some great cooking news in Wisconsin. We talked to you about Jen Barney a while back, the Wisconsin baker who won the Food Network's Holiday Baking Championship. She's from Stoddard. This week, a big competitive TV win for Wisconsin. Madison chef Tori Miller won Iron Chef Showdown. I missed it. I think I'll go back and watch it. Did you catch this one, Rob?
Ooh, I love Iron Chef. I caught it. Yeah, you're right. Wisconsin is crushing it in televised cooking competitions. Tori Miller of Gray's and other Madison spots won on meal using bison as the mystery ingredient, and it looks delicious. I'm in.
And he had a Wisconsin cheese, I think, that put him over the top.
That's right. His bandaged Wisconsin cheddar is the new Parmesan, and his quote in the show was, "In Wisconsin, we put cheese on everything," which I checked, and that checks out. That is true.
The fact check, true. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Menser, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us each Friday to recap the week's biggest state news stories. Now, in the setup for this story, we'll use language that some listeners may find inappropriate. President Trump reportedly used a vulgar slur in a meeting on immigration policy Thursday, referring to African nations as well as Haiti as shithole countries. The bipartisan meeting was part of negotiations around the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. And while the White House did not initially deny the president's remarks, the president stepped back from them in a tweet this morning denying any derogatory language towards Haiti. The language was condemned by United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Rupert Colville. Here's a listen.
These are shocking and shameful comments from the president of the United States. I'm sorry, but there's no other word one can use but racist. You cannot dismiss entire countries and continents as whose entire populations who are not white are therefore not welcome.
Jeremy Sir is with us now. He holds the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs, and he's a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, former history professor at UW-Madison. His latest book is The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Rob, happy to be on.
Your reaction to the reports of what the president was saying about immigrants from different countries?
It's outrageous. Presidents in the past have used off-color language at times, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon being the examples that come to mind, but they never used it to denigrate entire societies, and they never did it as a pattern of behavior that now with President Trump goes back more than a year to his anti-Muslim, anti-Mexican, and various other racist comments. And when they did it, Nixon and Johnson in the past, they would then apologize. And the absence of a Trump apology is almost more striking than the comment itself. It doesn't seem to bother him that much of the world thinks he's a racist. So this is outrageous, and this is a low point in the image of the United States in my lifetime.
A lot of the conversation has been around the profanity itself, but some people have been pointing to what appears to be a kind of an attempt to create a racial quota or at least a nationality-based quota, saying, hey, not Haiti and Africa, where most of the immigrants would be black. How about more countries like Norway, where theoretically most of the immigrants would be white?
Right. Well, I mean, the racial implications, I think, are obvious. And we do have a long history, unfortunately, in our society, Rob, of having quotas in immigration. Most notoriously, the Immigration Acts of the early 20th century limited Jewish immigrants, limited immigrants from Southern Europe, limited certainly immigrants from outside of Europe. But the 1965 Immigration Act transformed our society, opening our society to people, workers, and others from all parts of the world, students who hadn't been admitted to our society before. This is a huge step backwards. And even the advocates of immigration quotas in the past did not use quite the same racist language, at least not after World War II, as we've seen from this president.
Now, the president has made the case, and his defenders after this incident are saying, you know, what we're really saying is we don't want lower-skilled people coming from countries. We want to focus on admitting higher-skilled, more educated immigrants who will benefit the economy. What do you think of that idea?
Anyone who tries to defend it with that ridiculous argument is lying. This was not a comment about the quality of workers from one country or another. This was a blanket denigration of societies that have produced some of the best students who have been in my classroom, some of the hardest working individuals within our society, computer programmers, doctors, nurses, people who take care of us in hospitals. One could make an argument about the kinds of skills we want to see in people coming into our society, but that has nothing to do with the statement that was made by the president, which was pure racism, and anyone who defends it is defending racism.
What do you make of the reaction you've seen from Republicans? Here in Wisconsin, House Speaker Paul Ryan called the comments unfortunate and unhelpful and then talked about his own Irish roots. Republican Senator Ron Johnson said the president should apologize for the remark. What are you making of the response, especially from Republican leadership?
Well, you know, Rob, I'm glad that they aren't defending it, but I'm also very tired of people who know better saying the comments are unfortunate and then continuing to support, work with, pass legislation like a ridiculous tax bill for individuals who express these kinds of racist comments. There's really only one way to judge people. Who do you choose to associate yourself with? If you associate yourself with racists, even if you say the comments of the racist are unfortunate, you're defending racism, and we need to call out what it is. They have to stop calling it unfortunate. They have to start moving away, opposing the man who makes these statements.
Talking to a historian and public affairs professor, Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas Austin, about the president's remarks on immigrants and the nature of countries like Haiti and parts of Africa. Let's talk about the foreign policy implications here, Jeremy. We've seen people calling American ambassadors to the carpet in Haiti, Botswana, I think elsewhere. What does this do to American foreign policy in the Caribbean and in Africa?
Well, a very specific thing it does is it hinders our ability to fight terrorism. One of the priorities that we have had consistently since at least 2001 has been to keep our citizens and our society safe from those, and there are very few of them, but there are people out there who want to do us harm. Within each of the societies that the president used this derogatory term for, within each of the societies that the president has attacked with racist language for the last year, there are hundreds and thousands of intelligence agents and military officers from those societies who every day provide us information that help us to find and prosecute people who are trying to harm our society. I'm told by people in the intelligence world that that has stopped. Already, many of these local officials were not willing to work with Americans. Now they're even less willing than before. This makes every American less safe. Citizens of Wisconsin and Texas and New York are now less safe when they travel to the Middle East or Africa because of the president's comments.
A Republican strategist tweeted that he'd gotten in touch with a contact in Africa, and the contact said something back like, "Oh, I don't have time now. I'm going to take a class in Mandarin." And that points toward U.S. competition with China, China making big efforts to tap into markets in Africa and resource supplies in Africa. Does this hurt us potentially in economic relations with Africa?
Absolutely. We're watching this happen very explicitly throughout Asia right now, but in Africa as well, as we no longer have the prestige we had to convince countries that we're a better partner. The Chinese are often providing more money for aid projects, for road development projects, for things of that, with fewer strings attached, with less regulation. And they offer more to countries and countries that wanted to work with us before because they thought we were a defender of human rights and perhaps a better partner, now no longer stands that way. The Chinese are offering more money, and the Chinese look better than we do in many respects.
And we saw earlier today, unrelated to this incident, news came out that the U.S. ambassador to Panama had resigned, reportedly because he felt he couldn't represent the Trump administration anymore. This he had filed for this before these new comments. It was not related to those. But what do you make of morale in the U.S. diplomatic community right now?
So Rob, I just ran a workshop with a number of other scholars this last weekend with diplomats from around the world, including American diplomats. It's a workshop we run every year, and I've never seen such low morale among American diplomats. I also tell you that I train students at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, many of whom want to go into the Foreign Service. This is the first year I don't have large numbers of those students who want to take the Foreign Service exam. Our Foreign Service officials, who are hardworking diplomats, many appointed by Republicans as well as Democrats, they have incredibly low morale. And the talented, most talented young people in our society, many of whom would have gone into the Foreign Service before, people like young Condoleezza Rices and Jim Bankers and others, they're not interested in the Foreign Service anymore. This is a real problem for us.
What does this all do long-term for the United States' place on the global stage?
Well, this is where I think historical perspective is really important. One of the big advantages the United States has had since at least 1945 is that while many countries have had reasons to disagree and in many cases violently oppose us, they generally felt we were a better partner or at least a better country to work with than the alternatives, the Soviet Union or China. And we're losing that advantage. We're losing our brand. We're losing what some scholars call our soft power. And that is going to make every transaction, every relationship more expensive for us. At the university level now, we have to work harder to recruit the best foreign students to come to the U.S. Many of them now want to go to Germany or Canada or somewhere else instead where they're not going to be hassled by immigration. For businesses, I'm told, it's much harder now to recruit talent to come to the United States. We just talked about how talent is not moving into our government offices. So everything is going to be harder for us. Everything is going to be more costly because we will not have that historical advantage we have had of being seen as at least a little bit better than all of our peers around the world.
Do you see Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, having an opportunity to provide some kind of remedy to what you're talking about?
Well, That was a hope. I was one of many who believed, based on historical experience, that individuals coming into the State Department at the level of Secretary of State who have international experience and international prestige are able to do important work for the agency. But Tillerson has not been able to do that, and I don't have a clear reason why. I've talked to many people within the State Department, and they have different explanations. One is that he doesn't have support from the President of the United States, but one is perhaps that Tillerson himself doesn't believe in America's international mission. I think we have a group of leaders right now in Washington who don't understand the history of what made our society as influential and wealthy as it is, and it wasn't low taxes. It was our international presence. It was our ability to work and build relationships with other societies. It was our ability to recruit talent here. They don't understand that, and they're taking our country in the wrong direction. Most Americans understand what makes our country a great country, but our leaders don't. And so we're going in an unpopular, self-destructive direction. And the comments by the president are a further indication of the way in which our leaders in Washington are so far out of touch. Imagine any CEO making those comments. Imagine your boss making those comments, Rob. First, be fired.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm delighted to talk about these issues, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
That's Jeremy Suri, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, and author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. He joined us to talk about the president's remarks on nations in Africa, as well as Haiti, that have been generating controversy through the day today. First, a writer once known for provoking Manhattan's elite in his columns took aim at the White House and became an overnight sensation. Michael Wolff's new book, Fire and Fury, hit the shelves this week. It's an insider account from a year spent reporting on the Trump administration. The book is a scathing portrayal of the president and his inner circle. The president's lawyers have threatened to sue the publisher, and journalists have raised questions about the accuracy of Wolff's reporting. About a third of Americans see it as credible reporting, according to a poll by Morning Consult and Politico. Jane Kirtley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. She's the former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Jane, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, when you look at a book like this, it doesn't go along with a lot of standard journalistic standards. What do you make of a tell-all book like this?
Well, you know, I'm old enough to react to this book initially in the way I did to Kitty Kelly's books back in the 1980s and 90s, to think that there's probably a lot of truth in it, but there's also going to be some stuff that is not so easily verified. What concerns me about the book is that in some respects it can play into the narrative that says that the news media peddle fake news. And I think that's, for me, the biggest risk about a book like this. There are errors in the book. Again, not shocking that there would be mistakes. Even good investigative journalists can make mistakes in their reporting. But every mistake that's there is going to help undercut the credibility of the book. Having said that, I think it's an interesting book. I think it certainly has been a conversation starter, although events of the last 24 hours seem to have shifted our attention to other Trump-related topics. You know, it certainly isn't a book that I would hand to my students and say, this is the model of how investigative journalism should be done. But I think it's a provocative book, and it raises some important questions.
And here's what Wolff had to say about his reporting process to MSNBC's Katie Turr.
You have tapes. Are you going to release the tapes?
No, I'm going to do, you know, I have what every journalist, I work like every journalist. I have tapes, I have notes.
But if people are questioning it, why not produce the evidence?
Because that's not what I'm not in your business. My evidence is the book. Read the book. If it makes sense to you, if it strikes a chord, if it rings true, it is true.
Let's start with that last line. If it rings true, it is true. I mean, if that was the attitude expressed by a reporter at, in our news department here or a lot of newspapers around the country, they would soon, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, be ex-reporters, Jane.
I think you're correct. It's a fascinating era that we live in, isn't it? Because, of course, there have been people in the White House who have basically made exactly the same argument for some of the pronouncements that have come from the president or from his spokespeople. Essentially, it's true enough is basically the argument. And I think journalists have got to be better than that. Whatever the standards are for the Trump White House or any White House, we have to do better than that. So I don't find that line of argument persuasive at all.
And it seems like there's a continuum. I mean, there's the media, the journalism as we think of it practiced, where you try to be a little more on the ball. There's what Wolf is talking about. There are tabloid type of papers that print stuff that just doesn't seem to be true. There's online partisan websites that may be a little more fast and loose. What's a news consumer to do?
Well, that, of course, is the huge dilemma, isn't it? We're living in a time when we have more sources of information than ever before at our fingertips, and yet it's very difficult sometimes to determine which ones are credible and which ones are not. You know, there's been a call for greater media literacy. I used to kind of poo-poo that, but I've started to think that it really is necessary because there's just a lot of confusion out there. I mean, heaven knows we've had enough problems over the years for the general reader being able to distinguish between editorials and opinion columns and reporting the news. I think the universe is so much more confused now that it's often very difficult for people to tell the difference. And again, it goes back to this idea of if I have a partisan viewpoint and I want something to be true, I can assert it and just sit back and wait and see if anybody challenges me. That's just not the way journalists are supposed to work.
Talking to Jane Kirtley from the University of Minnesota. She's a professor of media ethics and law there. We're talking about the book Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff, a big conversation starter, a top seller now, but questions about its accuracy out there in its reporting on the Trump administration. Jane, when reporters in the mainstream media, I guess I'll just use the phrase, look at a book like this, and there are claims in there, some of which do appear to be true, some dicier, what's their role?
Well, I think any time we get a narrative about the administration or any other matter of public interest, we have an obligation to do our own independent reporting to try to determine whether it's true or false. I mean, just to take a really simple example, if the government makes a claim, we can report that claim, of course, and attribute it to the government and sit back and say, okay, I've done my job. Well, you haven't done your job because you've basically just been the public relations arm for the government. Your job is to go below the surface, behind the scenes, and try to determine whether it's truthful or not. If we are to believe what Wolf says about the way he got really extraordinary access to the Trump White House, he is probably privy to information that's not going to be easy to replicate or confirm. But I think we have an obligation to do that if we're going to publish it and put it out there for public consumption, because every time, in my judgment, a mainstream news organization does that, like it or not, they're putting their imprimatur on it, they're putting their credibility on it, unless they have, you know, a million disclaimers, which, frankly, most of them have not had, to say, essentially, these are the assertions in the book, but we have not been able to verify them independently.
Is it their job to take one assertion at a time and try to verify them? I mean, that could take a long time.
Well, it could, but, you know, think back to some of the, big exposés about government, and not just the Trump administration, going back to the Obama administration and earlier, where journalists did take days, weeks, and months to try to verify assertions that, you know, seemed either too terrible or too good to be true. Speed is not always the best way to get information to the public, although in this 24/7 environment we live in, it's very tempting to fall prey to that. Once you make a mistake, though, it really does hurt your credibility in the long run. And so this is one of the things, you know, we try to teach students in journalism school, going back to the old models of the Associated Press. You know, they always used to say, get it first, but get it right. And it seems to me that's something that's kind of getting lost in this rush to be first with a story.
And let's talk about this, the tell-all book of a sitting administration. Is this something that has a long history to it?
Well, there certainly have been examples in history of people within administrations writing books like this, but I guess that is what I would say is a difference here, that often they come from people that have left the administration and write it up afterwards. This is a little bit different because Wolf essentially is saying that he got this very special access where he just sort of sat in the West Wing for a year and listened, and it's been suggested that he basically exploited the naivete and inexperience of the White House staff, who for whatever reason seemed to think he was going to write a glowing book about President Trump, and in fact he did not, and there have certainly been instances of that in the past. You know, for me, the issue here is really ultimately not what all is in this book. I'm much more interested in the fact that President Trump was trying so hard to suppress it. Those are the traits of somebody who doesn't understand the way the First Amendment works and the way our system of government works. And for me, that's really the bigger story than the details in this particular book.
And we'll pick up on that point. We're talking to Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. We're looking at Michael Wolff's tell-all book, Fire and Fury, his portrayal of the Trump administration, met with some skepticism from journalists and others. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Have you read the book? Do you plan to? Do you think it's credible? Do you think it shares valuable information and insight or not? What are your reactions to President Trump's lawyers' threats for lawsuits and the president's talk about the need to change libel laws? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the best-selling book by Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury, and questions about the journalistic practices behind the book. Jane Kirtley is with us from the University of Minnesota. She's a professor of media ethics and law. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read this book? Are you gonna? Have you been reading excerpts and following the coverage? Do you buy it? Do you think it tells us something that we need to know? Or do you question whether it's really giving us the real deal? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Jane, we were just talking about the president's challenge and his lawyer's challenge to this book. Can you talk about that and why that has you concerned?
Yes. Let me start just by saying that some people perhaps might be wondering why they didn't just try to get an injunction to stop the publication of the book. And the short answer is that's almost impossible to do. Under our law, the Supreme Court has made clear that the remedy for libelous speech is a post-publication lawsuit, not an injunction. So the book's out. It was rushed out sooner than expected. And we had this long letter sent by Mr. Trump's lawyers to Henry Holt, the publisher, basically claiming a variety of causes of action, threatening libel, invasion of privacy, interference with contract, and a number of other claims. I think, obviously, I mean, I haven't read every single word of the book, but I would say that as a general proposition, it would be very difficult for the president to prevail in a libel suit. As a public official, he would have to prove what's called actual malice, which is knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. Again, without knowing more about Mr. Wolff's tapes, notes, et cetera, I can't say categorically that it would be impossible to prove that, but I would say it would be very difficult. He also sued under an invasion of privacy theory that is not recognized in the state where the action was brought, so that's not going to go anywhere. And the interference with contracts and so forth, this has been tried by other companies against the news media in the past and typically doesn't work because news media are not in a competitive position with the companies or the people they're writing about, and that's what those suits are typically for. So, and the last thing I would say is that I don't know if Mr. Trump fully realizes that he's been involved in libel litigation before, and he should. His lawyer's letter basically instructs Henry Holt that they're supposed to hold on to all the records and documents that they have. And the lawyer responded for Henry Holt, responded, said, we'll keep anything we're legally obliged to keep, but I just want to remind you that you will also have to keep documents and be subject to pretrial interrogation and pretrial discovery. I can't imagine that Mr. Trump and his administration really want to subject themselves to that. So I'm left with the conclusion that this is really just an attempt to frighten off Henry Holt and not realistically a likely libel case.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Drew is with us in Marshfield. Drew, hi.
Hi. A couple things. I'm listening to the same story from the Trump administration. Seems to sound like, you know, we're new at this, we didn't know better. How are we supposed to know that this author was going to paint us in a not-so-flattering light? Sort of mirrors a lot of their, you know, reaction when healthcare is very complicated or when tax reform isn't simple. There's a lot of naivety that's exposed there. And that is a lot of the sentiment that happens in this book. And in addition to that, there have been so many people that have leaked or spoken poorly about him, whether Trump's a, you know, explicative moron, that was Tillerson, I believe, or how he's got these midnight toilet tweets and cheeseburgers in bed. This isn't new information. It's just sort of aggregated now and compiled and organized for us to read it.
Drew, thanks for the call. Jane, he's saying in part that the meta story around the book and how the White House handled that access, as you were talking about, Drew says confirms some of the stories told inside the book about an administration not really knowing what it was doing.
I think that's fair, at least based on what I've seen about the book and read myself in the book. So in that sense, I suppose one could say, so what's the big deal here? And that's why I go back to my point that in and of itself, maybe it's not that big a deal, but the president's reaction to it, I think, is a very big deal indeed. Those kinds of, bullying statements and attempts to suppress commentary that he doesn't like or disagrees with really are not part of what should be the structure in the United States.
Thanks for that call. And the president had talked about wanting to look into libel law and change it. I understand that libel law is the purview of state law for the most part, not federal law. Do I have that right?
That's correct. There is no federal libel law. There is a federal law that prohibits enforcing libel judgments from other countries that are contrary to the First Amendment. But beyond that, it is a matter of state law. So even if the president wanted to, he could not change the law in 50 states and the District of Columbia. That would have to be done by the individual legislatures.
So what are you hoping for from the media now and covering the Trump administration? There's been a lot of talk about how to cover an administration that presents alternative facts, as has come out earlier, a lot of fact checks ruling against them. What do you look for from journalists?
Well, what I'm looking for right now is, and this is not always going to be easy, but I think it really is important to persist in asking questions and also doing investigative journalism behind the scenes. You probably have heard, your readers have probably heard about some of the most recent confrontations between the Dutch press and the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, and how they have said, we're not going to let you not answer the questions we're asking you in a press conference. We're going to persist until you answer them. And I think that's something that the U.S. Media pool, particularly the White House pool, should be thinking about doing a little bit more often. I understand the desire to move on to the next question, to your question, but I think if the question's a good one, we really should be demanding better answers, more complete answers, maybe contradictory answers. We've certainly seen the president vacillate on a variety of topics. He's not always consistent, and I wouldn't want to have to be a spokesperson and have to keep up with all of that. But it really is up to the press, I think, to persist in asking those questions and demanding those answers.
We'll leave it there for now. Jane, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Jane Curtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. She's the former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. She joined us to take a closer look at Michael Wolff's controversial book about the Trump administration, Of Fire and Fury. You can share your thoughts on this still over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you read this book? Are you going to read it? What do you think about it? Do you buy it? Do you think it presents a realistic picture? Or you have doubts about it? Tell us about that, too. Again, that's at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Following the fatal shooting of unarmed black 19-year-old Tony Robinson by a Madison police officer in 2015, a citizen committee was formed to review the department's policies and procedures. They hired a California-based consulting firm to complete that study. Bridget Bowden now has more on what they found.
Last night, the Madison Common Council met with a Citizen Police Review Committee to hear the final report from the OIR Consulting Group. That group has been working on the study for the past year. It includes 146 recommendations intended to improve the policies and practices of the Madison Police Department. The report challenges the department to reflect on if it's actually the model department that it claims to be. Here's OIR consultant Stephen Connolly.
It's a progressive agency in a lot of ways. And we were very, very impressed by a lot of the personnel that we met and the talent and commitment and dedication that those folks have.
But he says there's a flip side to that dedication.
Because the department does so many things so well, and because it is so conscientious about being on top of things, there can be a what we perceive was a little bit of a resistance to criticism at times, almost like an indignation at times.
The department says it's committed to community policing and aims to dedicate 50% of officers' time to it. But the report found that non-traditional police activities like de-escalation and problem solving aren't tracked because officers don't keep a daily activity log. Here's consultant Michael Giannacco.
The ironic thing is that traditional policing activity is captured very easily, because when you arrest somebody, when you cite somebody, there is a paper trail that you need to prepare.
So one of the recommendations is to require officers to log all of their activities, including community policing.
It really just means after you have engaged in this community policing, document it. Get into your car, get on your MDC, your computer, and just say, I did not need to arrest this gentleman because we worked it out this way. Full stop. That's it.
These records could then be compiled to identify trends and show if the department is living up to its own high expectations. The report recommends implementing an annual performance evaluation for all employees, including the chief. MPD doesn't currently do this. It also recommends that the city hire an independent auditor to oversee things like citizen complaints and use of force. This person would report to a community review board. Giannacco says the auditor would eliminate the need for future studies like this one.
In our view, the independent police auditor function could and should sort of fill the role that we sort of did by identifying issues and also reporting regularly an unvarnished perspective outside the department about what's going on in the department.
The council approved $400,000 for this study after a contentious meeting in the summer of 2016. According to the OIR group, they ended up spending only $372,000. Alder Mark Clear says it was money well spent.
I think it was worth it. It was expensive, and I think that you justified that expense.
Alder Samba Balde says the goal of the review and the recommendations is ultimately to build trust.
I think we want to get to a position where the community trusts the police and the police trusts the community.
The police department is expected to respond to the recommendations in 2 to 3 weeks. The committee and the...
That was Bridget Bowden reporting. Coming up Monday on Central Time, good timing might seem like luck, but our guest says there's a lot of science behind it. We'll talk to the author of the new book, When. We'll find out whether Wisconsin is likely to add a girls-only division to the high school wrestling season. And it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We'll hear excerpts from a speech made here in Wisconsin by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Also, be sure to tune in at noon on Monday for live coverage of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. tribute and ceremony. That'll be live from the Capitol Rotunda in Madison. And you can hear that here on the Ideas Network. That's all coming up Monday on Central Time.